Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up this hour, Katerina Sestarek on work at the Iowa State House as this 2021 session draws to a close. Cassidy Arena, she'll have a remembrance of a Midwest public radio journalist killed by an apparent stray bullet. Also, the AP's Ryan Foley will be along. He'll talk about why Iowa recently moved nearly 300,000 registered voters to inactive status. But let's start the hour, as we often like to do on Fridays, with an update on our vaccination campaign. IPR health reporter Natalie Krebs is with me. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Ben.
So what's the picture of the latest data on where we are in terms of shots in arms in the state?
Yeah, so we're at the point where over a million people now in Iowa are fully vaccinated. About 2.4 million people in Iowa are over the age of 18, according to the most recent census data. So that still puts us at less than half of eligible Iowans being fully vaccinated. I think it's about just over 43% by my last calculation. So, you know, numbers are slowly ticking up, but, you know, again, not even at that 50% mark for those who are fully vaccinated.
Right. And within the last few days, we've reached a turning point of sorts in that up to this point, demand far outstripped supply. And now we have supply there not being used, right?
Yeah, we've seen kind of a startling shift this month. I mean, April's been a big month for the vaccine. April 5th was the day Iowa opened all shots to everyone who's eligible. It's people 16 and older, pretty much. You know, about 3 days later, April 8th, you know, the state had reported that 21 counties had declined all or part of their vaccine allocation. That was due to the fact that they just didn't have enough demand for it. And now we're all the way up to, for next week, the week of May 3rd, 80 of Iowa's 99 counties have declined all or part of their vaccine allocation. Again, just saying they don't have enough demand for the supply that they're given, and it's, again, a complete 180 from what we saw even just a month ago.
Yeah, and as you've reported before, we hear from the CDC, we need to reach 70-80% for that herd immunity. We're not up to 50% here in Iowa. Talk a little bit about the efforts to dialogue with those who have held back until now, who are mulling over whether they want to get a shot or not.
Yeah, so state health officials, Governor Reynolds, she's talked about in the last couple weeks, they've been reaching out to local health departments, local communities to see where vaccine hesitancy lies. Reynolds last week during her last televised press conference talked about, you know, really working with the big universities to get students vaccinated before they go home for summer, just because they're looking at that younger population, you know, it tends to be one of the highest groups, you know, that doesn't want to get the vaccine. You know, hearing from local health departments, again, they just talk about that low-risk population, so younger people, people without underlying conditions, you know, people between, like, about 18 to 50, are the ones that are kind of the most blowing off the vaccine the most. They think, you know, a lot of those people are young, they're healthy. Some people don't even get symptoms if they get COVID-19. And, you know, some of these experts have been basically telling me that these are the type of people who don't really feel like they need to get vaccinated.
Mm, yeah, but you're doing a great community effort, a national effort here for all of us when you do get vaccinated. Hey, Natalie, I had my second, happened to be a Pfizer shot this week on Wednesday. Happy to report, and also happy to report I had no after effects, no side effects whatsoever. Here's a little bit of audio of me showing up with my white vaccine card for its second stamp at a University of Iowa hospitals and clinics facility in North Liberty.
Morning,
all good to go?
I think
a little white card for your appointment.
You know, I actually remembered that.
You're a good man. Across the aisle to the right side of the black post coming down there.
All right, thanks.
Don't hit.
Good morning.
Okay, I've been continually impressed with both my shots, and I've been hearing from others, Natalie, how well run these clinics are across the state. A wonderful feeling to know when we put our mind to something that we can all chip in and try to get us back to more normal life, allow businesses to fully open, and to get people fully vaccinated so we don't endanger ourselves or endanger others. What are fully immunized people allowed to do safely, according to the CDC?
Yeah, so fully immunized, which again, a reminder, that's 2 weeks after your last dose, so your second dose for Pfizer and Moderna, or after your Johnson & Johnson shot. I think the biggest thing this week is the CDC said people who are fully vaccinated no longer need to wear a mask outdoors while walking, running, hiking, biking alone, in small gatherings, including members of their own households. But, I mean, masks are still necessary in crowded outdoor venues, like sports stadiums or big outdoor events. But, you know, previous guidance and the CDC keeps issuing more and more guidelines as more and more people get vaccinated. But if you are fully vaccinated, you can gather indoors with fully vaccinated people. You don't have to wear a mask or stay 6 feet apart. You can, again, conduct, you know, activities outdoors without wearing a mask, except in certain crowded settings. Travel, that's a big thing. People have been kind of stuck inside for the last year, but they're saying if you travel in the United States, you don't need to get tested before or after travel or self-quarantine. So you're pretty much able to travel if you're fully vaccinated. So, you know, the CDC keeps issuing more and more guidance, but these are just some of the things that they say that you're able to safely do if you're fully vaccinated.
Yeah, a wonderful feeling, getting your second vaccination, having that mm-hmm. white vaccine card. You want to keep that. You may need that. And, it's all part of recovering from this horrible pandemic we've been experiencing for the past year. Natalie Krebs, glad you're with us to report on developments in our vaccine campaign. We'll be back with you in a future show. Thank you, Natalie.
Thank you, Ben.
It's our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week on the 30th day of April, 2021. Well, the 2021 legislative session is nearing its end. It's not over yet, but let's get an update from IPR state government reporter Katarina Sestarek. Katarina, hi.
Hi, Ben.
How close are lawmakers to the end of this session?
Well, today was the target date, technically, for ending the session. This is the day that the daily stipends paid to state lawmakers to cover their expenses during the session, that runs out today. And so they are going to be continuing on, though, because they haven't passed the state budget yet, at least for another week. It's not clear exactly when it'll end. And so, you know, there's still a lot of things, major budget and tax proposals that the top Republicans in the legislature are still trying to figure out. And one of the major sticking points, according to House Speaker Pat Grassley, is the Senate's proposed takeover of mental health funding. The Senate wants the state to pay for mental health services as opposed to it's currently funded by county-based property taxes. I mean, there are just a whole bunch of other things that they're still negotiating.
Right. And as you reported, I think improving child care access and affordability is also one of those things here at the end.
Right. There are some several child care related proposals that the House passed on a bipartisan basis. And these are things that the Senate has still not passed in their chamber. So that's going to be part of the negotiations as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about advances for the so-called vaccine passport ban. Tell us, remind us, first of all, what would this bill prohibit?
This is a bill that came up this week, at the beginning of this week, and it would ban the state as well as local governments from issuing any sort of IDs that say whether someone has gotten the COVID-19 vaccine. And then it also essentially discourages businesses from requiring proof of COVID-19 vaccination to come onto the property by saying any business that does that won't be eligible for future state-funded grants or contracts. And there are exceptions for healthcare facilities. And this bill also wouldn't affect the employer-employee relationship in terms of talking about, you know, asking someone whether they've gotten a COVID-19 vaccine. And this passed with some bipartisan support and some bipartisan opposition in the Iowa House this week.
Interesting. Yeah. Give us a sense of the reasoning here, a sense of the debate on each side over this so-called vaccine passport.
Well, there are some concerns that some of the language is just maybe too vague or not clear in terms of what exactly is prohibited. And then there's a small group of Republican lawmakers who thought the bill didn't go far enough. And thought there shouldn't be an exemption for healthcare facilities and or an exemption for employees. And Representative Stephen Holt, who's the lead Republican on this bill, said, you know, long-term care facilities have to be able to know who's vaccinated in order to follow CDC guidance and to keep their residents safe. And as we know, there have been over 2,000 residents of nursing homes who died of COVID during the pandemic. And so that exception for healthcare facilities is important to a lot of lawmakers.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other bills. Grant Gerlach, our colleague, reported on efforts to expand the state's public-funded charter school program. That was a bill that this week made it to the governor's desk, right?
Right. So this is a proposal that would give a new pathway to create charter schools in Iowa. And it was part of Governor Reynolds' big school choice package of policy proposals that she put out at the beginning of the session. And so now this is one of her big priorities that's heading to her desk. And it's something that, you know, Republican supporters of this are saying that this can fill some gaps in the education system for maybe if a traditional public school isn't working for particular students. But Democrats are saying, you know, we should just be putting public money into bettering public schools that already exist.
Mm-hmm. Also, later in the hour, Katarina, we'll be hearing from Katie Pikus about a case involving the renewable fuel standard that is, oral arguments were heard before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. But meanwhile, here in Iowa, Governor Reynolds has been still pushing for a bill to boost the renewable fuels industry here in the state. Tell us where that is at.
Yeah, so Reynolds proposed essentially a state renewable fuel standard. Lawmakers have been working on amendments for that. It hasn't passed either chamber, though. And yesterday, there was another subcommittee meeting, which is where members of the public and lobbyists have a chance to give some input on a bill held yesterday in the Senate. But, you know, the Speaker of the House, Pat Grassley, saying, you know, there's still a lot of opposition to the bill, particularly from gas stations and transportation interests, and that it would be a difficult push to get this bill through by the end of the session. And Governor Reynolds said, you know, if it doesn't happen this session, she's not going to give up on it. And she's planning to bring all stakeholders together before the next session to try to find something that everyone can agree on.
Mm-hmm. And let's finish up with this broad bipartisan support for a new broadband law signed into law this week by the governor. What does it do?
Right. This was another one of Governor Reynolds' major priorities for this session. It creates a broadband grant program so that service providers can put in the infrastructure to have high-speed internet across the state. And most of the grants would require capacity for download and upload speeds of 100 megabits per second. And this obviously needs to have some money with it, though, which hasn't been signed into law yet, but both the House and the Senate have now approved $100 million for the first year of these grants. Reynolds had proposed $150 million in each of the next 3 years, but she said she's thrilled with the amount that they've approved and that there may be opportunities for federal funding to fill in the rest of what she wanted.
Okay, Katarina, before we go, remind us again, and you mentioned at the outset that the session is nearing an end. It's not over yet. What will you be looking for next week? Could it finish up next week? Sessions have a way of going on and on when they get stuck, don't they?
Right. I think technically it could, but it seems like there's still major tax and budget issues that need to be worked out for it to be over.
Okay. Thank you for your reporting. We'll keep track of that. Thanks to you and other reporters at Iowa Public Radio. State government reporter Katerina Sestarek. Thank you so much, Katerina. Have a wonderful rest of your Friday.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we end this half, unfortunately, on a tragic note. It was a week ago that a shooting resulted in the death of an esteemed young Midwestern public radio journalist. Last Friday, in Kansas City, Missouri, a reporter for NPR member station KCUR died after being struck by a bullet that pierced her home window. Aviva Okeson Haberman was just 24 years old, a rising star in public radio. Joining me now, one of Aviva's friends and a former colleague, IPR reporter Cassidy Arena. Cassidy, welcome to the program. I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your friend and former colleague. So painful to hear about a young life tragically cut short. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ben. I really appreciate having the time to remember Aviva.
What can you tell us, first of all, about the circumstances? What do we know about what happened?
Yeah, so you summed it up pretty well. As far as what we do know, KCUR reported that Aviva was in her home Friday night and a bullet, I guess, struck through the window and hit her. After not responding to colleagues reaching out, et cetera, one of her colleagues actually went in to go and check on her. She was then taken to a hospital in Kansas City, where she was on life support. And, I've been told that she was with her family, when they decided to, end the life support.
Cassidy, the investigation, I assume, is ongoing. A lot of unanswered questions, namely, where did that bullet come from?
Yes. So the Kansas City police are currently investigating the shooting that did result in her death. Actually, on the same night, KCUR reported that five other gunshot victims were also taken to the same hospital.
Let's talk a little bit about Aviva as a journalist. First of all, as I mentioned, a real young rising star in public radio is what reports are saying. You knew her personally. You worked with her personally. Let me play a little sample of her work, a couple of pieces blended together, just so we hear her voice and hear a little bit about the high quality of work that she was responsible for.
On a recent May morning at Missouri's Capitol Rotunda, abortion rights activists are chanting, "Stop the ban." Mevi Mead is in the thick of it. She's the director of policy and organizing for Planned Parenthood Advocates. She says of all the legislation she's seen, this is the most extreme.
Adult Abuse and Neglect Hotline.
The call center for Missouri's Adult Abuse Hotline is housed in a nondescript building in Jefferson City. When you walk in, there are signs asking you, shh, be quiet. Employees work in cubicles answering calls and typing up reports on what they hear. Displaying on their screen shows what each of their coworkers is doing. When I visited, there were 9 people working on the hotline.
Why didn't you personally decide to filibuster? I mean, you could have done that, right?
Well, I mean, it takes more than one person to filibuster. I mean, it takes an effort.
The bill now goes to the House, where the original version already passed. Then it's on to the governor. In Jefferson City, I'm Aviva Okeson Haberman.
So we heard a sample of some of the work of Aviva Okeson Haberman, who was killed last week by an apparent stray bullet. Cassidy, tell us a little bit more about her work as a journalist. What was it like working with her?
Some of the work that we just heard was actually used as an example for other student journalists. Even though she, you know, was by no means a professional yet, she was actually still in school, and her work was used as an example of what other students should be doing. So that just gives you an idea of how incredibly talented that she is and she was. You know, just as a student looking at another student saying, okay, this is who I should be like, you know, it's very obvious. And I hope that I can reflect some of what Aviva has taught me and some of how she's influenced my journalism. I hope that I continue to reflect that in my future work as well.
Mm-hmm. Cassidy, tell us a little bit about Aviva as a person, as a friend. I understand she was a very caring, giving person.
Yes. And part of that was also just always being present. Everybody in the journalism school at the University of Missouri were so close. And we had a table down in our work lab called the kitchen table. And I'm going to tell you about 80% of the time Aviva was there. She was there to politely decline your pitches if they weren't that great. But she was also there to build you up. The very last conversation that we had, she was actually going over all of my job applications to make sure that I looked as strong as possible. And she went out of her way to make sure that other people succeed, even though she had her own work to worry about and to focus on. So that just gives you a little tiny snippet of just how amazing, not only an amazing journalist, but a truly amazing person.
Mm-hmm. And we have her to thank for you being with Iowa Public Radio. I understand she was a reference for you.
Yes, and she looked over my application and she looked over my resume. So there is a little bit of spark of Aviva that continues to live on even in Iowa Public Radio, and that's just a small summary of where her memory lives on.
Cassidy, before we go, tell us a little bit about a memorial fund. What has been set up in Aviva's name?
Yes, there are a few ways that other people can continue Aviva's memory. One way is to send a contribution to the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, because that is how she lost her life. Another way, KCUR, in partnership with KBIA, both of the radio stations that she worked with, are running a memorial fund for future aspiring journalists, and people can go to KCUR web donate. .umkc.edu to donate to that fund to help change the world through journalism, just like Aviva did.
Okay, thank you very much. And again, our condolences, our thoughts go to you and, of course, to the family, Aviva's family. Aviva Okeson Haberman, just 24 years old, killed last Friday in Kansas City, Missouri, struck by a bullet that pierced her home window. And Cassidy, you take care. Thank you very much for helping us remember this amazing young individual who lost her life.
Thank you, Ben.
We'll be back after a short break. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case involving the renewable fuel standard. Katie Pikus joins us. She'll tell us what that might mean, that case before the U.S. Supreme Court might mean for Iowa's biofuel industry. Also, I'll be joined by the AP's Ryan Foley. He'll tell us why Iowa moved nearly 300,000 registered voters to inactive status. That's when we continue. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case involving the renewable fuel standard. IPR's Katie Pikus joins me now to explain the case and what it might mean for Iowa's biofuel industry. Katie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, let's make sure we're all on board in understanding what the Renewable Fuel Standard, which often goes by its acronym RFS, means in the first place. Where did it come from?
Yeah, so the Renewable Fuel Standard is a federal program created by Congress to lower greenhouse gas emissions. And under the RFS, a certain amount of renewable fuels, which includes ethanol, has to be blended into the nation's transportation fuel supply every year. And those amounts increase every year.
Okay, and that's where Iowa comes in, because in the meantime, Iowa's become a big corn alcohol, an ethanol producer, a big biofuel center for the country with all of our corn. So explain this case, the basics of what this case that made it to the Supreme Court is about, how it reached the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sure. So small refineries were allowed to get exemptions from their requirements to blend renewable fuels into their gasoline if they could prove that they were struggling financially. And there were a lot of these so-called waivers granted by the Trump administration. So in early 2020, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Trump administration's EPA overreached in its authority, in particular with granting three refineries exemptions from their blending requirements. And the appellate court basically said that small refineries can only get extensions of their exemptions from blending renewable fuels into their gasoline if they've already been continuously exempt from those requirements. So we saw that refineries appealed the 10th Circuit ruling, and the Supreme Court agreed to take it up, and they heard arguments earlier this week.
Katie, based on the way you emphasized the word continuously in that explanation, that makes me feel that that is at the heart of this case. That is what is being argued over.
Basically, so the big thing on center stage was basically how each side defines the word extension. And, you know, that's the whole thing about small refineries continuing to get a pass on their blending requirements. So we heard from Peter Keisler, the attorney for the refining companies, and he said that small refineries that had an exemption from the RFS when it was created, he said that they can extend it at any time that they want if they're struggling financially. And he said that there is not a dictionary definition out there that says extension requires continuity. And on the other side of things, we heard from Matthew Morrison. He's an attorney for the Renewable Fuels Association and other biofuels groups. And he argued that the word extension means to prolong something. And basically, he said that the EPA can prolong an exemption from blending requirements, but they can't create something new. And we also heard from Christopher Michelle, who represents the EPA. And the EPA, earlier this year when we had an administration change, when the Biden administration came in, the EPA changed its position on the 10th Circuit ruling, and they sided with the biofuels industry. So we heard from Christopher Michelle for the EPA. He said that the EPA cannot give a small refinery something that does not exist anymore. In other words, if they no longer had an exemption from blending requirements, if it went away because they were not facing any more financial hardships, they can't get an extension because they don't have their exemption anymore. So those were sort of the two sides that we heard, as well as the EPA, which supported the renewable fuels industry.
I wonder, Katie, based on how these oral arguments took place, were presented, is there any way to know how the court is likely to decide in this case?
It's really hard to say, and I don't believe we'll expect a decision for at least a couple of months. There were a couple of scenarios brought up during, from the justices themselves, where they challenged the attorneys using basic situations of the word extension. So it was interesting to sort of hear like real world uses of the word extensions. For example, like if you asked for an extension of your lease of an apartment, but your lease had expired, you know, your lease had run out 5 years ago. You know, they used basic examples like that to ask the two sides those questions. And yeah, I would say that there really is not a way to know how they'll decide at the moment.
Okay, so there's a lot at stake here, Katie Pikus. What is the potential impact of this decision?
So if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the refiners, there's this fear from the renewable fuels industry that the EPA could hand out more and more small refinery exemptions. And the renewable fuels industry says that that could continue to really hurt demand for renewable fuels. And on the other side of things, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the biofuels industry, I'm not really sure how much would change necessarily. I think that a lot of pressure and worries would be taken off, but that's kind of the more difficult side to determine the potential effect of.
Okay, we'll wait for the U.S. Supreme Court decision on the renewable fuel standard. Oral arguments heard this week. IPR's Katie Pikus will be watching that for us. Thank you very much, Katie, for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our state recently marked nearly 300,000 Iowa voters as inactive. Inactive. It's part of Iowa's new election law, rewriting voting rules in our state. Ryan Foley of the Associated Press has been following the story. He joins me now. Hello again, Ryan.
Hello, Ben.
So this is interesting. You confirmed with Iowa's election office that 294,000 Iowans registered to vote were recently marked as inactive. What does that mean?
Well, it means that they did not vote in the most recent general election. And under a new law that was passed in March by the legislature and signed by Governor Kim Reynolds, anyone who does not vote in a general election, so every 2 years, either the midterms or the presidential race in this case, they are marked as inactive the following March. And what that means is the state will send them a postcard asking them to confirm their current address. And if they respond to that card and confirm that they still live where they live, they will be returned to active status. If they do not, they will remain in inactive status, which should have no immediate impact on them in terms of voting this year or next year or 2023 or 2024. But if they do not vote or update their registration in that four-year period, they could be removed from the voter rolls.
Mm-hmm. And why did Republicans feel this change was necessary?
Yeah, this is part of a nationwide push for what's called voter list maintenance. The idea is to make sure that local voting rolls are accurate and up to date as much as possible. That they have people's current addresses. That they do not have people who move out of jurisdictions. The concern is that having voter rolls that are inaccurate might invite fraud, although, as we know, that's very rare.
Mm-hmm. You highlighted in your story, Ryan, that several hundred 17-year-old Iowans were marked as inactive, even though they were registered but could not vote because of their age, right? So they had no way to get off the inactive status?
That's correct. And the Iowa Secretary of State's office says, while the law, applies to all registered voters, and they didn't vote even though they couldn't vote in the 2020 election, so they're being moved to inactive status. But again, if they return the postcard or if they update the registration or vote anytime in the next, through 2024, it should really have no impact on them.
Okay. Well, Democrats, specifically a Linn County auditor you cited in your story, don't like this new rule. They call it a chill to voters. So what is meant by that?
Well, you know, the Iowa Secretary of State and others do spend a lot of time getting young people to register to vote even before they turn 18. You know, under a new Iowa law that just went into effect in 2019, people can register to vote when they turn 17. But I think this, until this is addressed, it doesn't make a lot of sense to get 17-year-olds pre-registered if they're going to be moved to inactive right away. Mm-hmm. The argument is that, you know, voters might be confused by this. They're hearing from voters who are upset that they're being listed as inactive. Maybe they had good reasons not to vote in 2020. That, you know, ultimately the fear is some of these voters that, you know, will be purged from the rolls in a few years here.
Mm-hmm. So the message here, just to go back over what you said before, if you didn't vote in the last election but are a registered voter, and this is nearly 300,000 people, so certainly a great number of people listening to my voice, if you receive, you should receive a card from the Iowa Secretary of State, Paul Pate's office, and make sure you return it, and then you will be taken off this inactive status, right?
That's right. You'll be moved back to active status. And if you have, say you've moved, but in the same county, you'll check this box and give them your new address and you'll be returned to active status. If you have moved to a different county, you need to tell them that, but you also need to take some steps with the new county auditor where you live to update your status.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned it was back in March. We know that the governor signed these new voting rules into law, many aspects to it, giving Iowans less time to vote, making it harder to vote by mail, enacting other changes in the state's election procedures. And as you mentioned, many other Republican states, controlled states, have enacted new voter laws as well. Despite strong opposition from Democrats, Democrats claiming Republicans want to suppress voter groups that tend to vote Democratic. I wonder, sort of outside the scope of this article, Ryan, if you have any observations about how Iowa's new election laws compare with actions of other states.
Iowa was one of the first states, and we're seeing others following suit, to enact some pretty new aggressive laws in response to, what Republicans say are some of the problems that they spotlighted in 2020. Although, many observers and Democrats say that was an incredibly successful election that had, you know, very little fraud and high turnout in the middle of a pandemic. So I think it's a little early to say exactly where Iowa's changes fit in, because Iowa was one of the first. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of states are still considering how which changes to make.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk with you about another story that you had published this week, Ryan, about a threat. An Iowa man is charged with leaving a threatening voicemail telling our governor, Kim Reynolds, she should be, in his words, hung for treason. He defended his comments this week. Tell us about this man and what happened this week.
Yeah, Harvey Hunter Jr. Is a 48-year-old truck driver from Stewart, Iowa. He's a self-described conservative who tells me that he does believe central parts of the QAnon conspiracy theory. Called the governor's office line that had been set up to gather feedback on whether, back in January, on whether she should continue the statewide mask mandate. And he left a profane and, according to the Iowa Department of Public Safety, you know, threatening voice message that said that, yeah, she, in his words, she should be hung for treason, that she's acting like a dictator with these by imposing COVID-19 restrictions. That's what he was upset about. He is defending his comments in an interview with me. He said that he was, you know, using his First Amendment right to express his intense opposition to COVID-19 restrictions. And that, yes, his tone was harsh, but that's what he believed.
Mm-hmm. Harsh, harsh in saying, quote, you need to be put in front of a firing squad, that kind of harsh. He is scheduled for trial in June, as you reported. The charge and possible consequences for Harvey Hunter Jr.
Yes, he's charged with first-degree harassment, which is an aggravated misdemeanor that carries up to 2 years in prison. He has pleaded not guilty, and trial is scheduled for June, as you mentioned.
Okay. And when you spoke with him, Ryan, what kind of man did he strike you as?
I think he's been struggling during the pandemic financially. He told me he'd been struggling with a health issue that he's getting surgery for next month. He said that it had been delayed because of COVID-19. But he tried to argue that he was not some anti-government militia person, that he's a small government conservative who's just very upset about COVID-19 restrictions. I told him that, well, a lot of public health experts would say that the governor hasn't done enough to stem the virus in Iowa. And he just he doesn't believe that it is killing anyone. He doesn't believe that it's the mask mandate or other public health measures were warranted.
Okay. Ryan Foley, a reporter for the Associated Press. Ryan, always good to talk with you. Thanks for the great reporting.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And to finish up this News Buzz edition of River to River, Tony Daynard joins me of Iowa Public Radio Studio One team. He's a Trax host along with Mark Simmet and CC Mitchell. Tony, hi.
Hey, Ben.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm looking out the window at the sunshine.
So am I.
I'm like, I hope all of us spend a lot of time in the sunshine. Dennis will tell us about the weather. We'll find out if we have that sunshine continuing into the weekend. But what about your tracks grooving us into the weekend? What do you have for us?
Yeah, a couple new albums that are out today. First one is the first full-length album from Girl in Red. This is the project of a young woman named Marie Ulven from Norway. Very honest and straightforward songs with sentiments about being a young queer woman trying to make her way. And these are just great pop songs. Like I said, this album, If I Could Make It Go Quiet, her first full-length album, it is out today, but we've been playing the first single off of this album for a while. This is Girl in Red and Serotonin.
I'm running low on serotonin. Chemical imbalance got me twisting things. Stabilized with medicine. There's no depth to these feelings. Dig deep, can't hide from the corners of my mind. I'm terrified of what's inside. I get intrusive thoughts like cutting my hands off, like jumping in front of a bus, like how do I make the stop when it feels like my therapist hates me. Please don't let me go crazy. Put me in a field with daisies. Might not work, but I'll take a maybe. Been breaking daily, but only me can save me. So I'm capitulating, crying like a silly baby. I don't wanna miss a bala. I don't wanna be cicada. I don't love it.
Oh, Tony, you picked one. They are running low on serotonin.
Such a happy accident. I picked this song yesterday afternoon.
So nice. Man. Interesting lyrics and a very catchy tune. Wow. I don't know if you can top that, Tony, going into the weekend.
Well, I'm going to try. So here's a band that's very far removed from their debut album, Guided by Voices. They've been around since 1983, except for a bit of a hiatus in there, about an eight-year hiatus. Ben, this is one of the busiest bands out there. They have put out 10 albums in the past 4 years. Mm. They've put out now 33 albums with this new one that is out today, which is called Earthman Blues. And according to our own Mark Simmet, this is their best album since their 32nd album. This is Guided by Voices and Trust Them Now.
just enough. So when I call on you, I will, with nothing else to measure. Your attic trash from buried treasure. Horizontal monsters are rising up for selfish pleasure. Parts unknown and nowhere to be found.
Trust Them Now from Guided by Voices. Tony, another winner there, grooving us into the weekend and pumping us up with some energy with these tunes. Tony, remind us how we can listen to Studio One, you and the other Trax hosts and the music.
Yeah, so Studio One Trax is on 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. Also, Saturday afternoons from 2 to 4 o'clock.
Tony, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
And I want to remind our listeners that on Monday, we'll be talking about returning to work, your pre-pandemic workplace, or perhaps you're continuing to work from home and you love it. We'd love to hear about your experiences as we wind down this COVID work experiment. Email your experience to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And tune in on Monday. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
I saw the fisted cuff, sang through the fingers empty. The loved ones that you did not love, and do not trust them, trust them.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.